Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Chris Evans here. A big thank you for downloading our Virgin Radio podcast. Coming up on this week's edition of The Best of the Breakfast Show with Sky, Jason Donovan chats his big return to the stage in Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. Richard Dreyfuss talks Jaws and where he keeps his Oscar. Amanda Abington gives us the latest on her brand new five-star play, The Sun, which transfers to the West End from the Kiln Theatre in London in August. Plus loads more great guests. Enjoy, my friends, enjoy.
He's the heartthrob to end all heartthrobs. 28 years after starring in it, he's bringing his star quality back to Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat at the London Palladium. Please welcome the Scot to our Charlene, the wonder from Down Under, the legend that is Jason Donovan.
Good morning,
Jason. Good morning.
Welcome.
That was incredible. What an introduction. And the tone, it sort of went down here into a little bit of a radio sort
beautiful.
Of voice.
Silky, it's resonant, it's everything you want it to be.
Jamajvaj.
Quite, almost. Right. Anyway, you're doing so well. All right, Thursday the 27th of June to Sunday the 8th of September, London Palladium. Thank you, Jason. Goodbye. Right. Buy tickets from josephthemusical.com. Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. You're going there again, but you don't have the coat. The coat is not yours this time.
No. I mean, look, it was a sort of an opportunity to... you never know the value of a moment until it becomes a memory. And there was many memories shared at the Palladium back in 1991. I didn't want to wear the loincloth again.
Right.
Andrew rang me up last year and said, what do you think? And I thought, this sounds perfect. I think with music, you know, we tend to look back a lot, but not with sort of theatrical productions. And this is a reimagined Joseph, with me playing the Pharaoh.
All right, so the world of musicals, okay?
Yeah.
You go back Thursday. You haven't played this role before, but you've been around this role before.
Yes.
You've seen other people play this role before. So who have you been most inspired by? Who are you going to nick things from that you've seen do it really well in the past?
Well, I only really saw David Easter, who was the Pharaoh. And I've listened to various interpretations on YouTube and, you know, and on my iPad and my iPhone and Apple and all those sort of things. Look, I sort of have always approached these things as, you know, I look at what's in front of me and just get on with it. It has obviously a sort of a reflection on the Elvis, but I'm not an Elvis, you know, impersonator. Although I do pay sort of homage to that in my performance.
Can you have more fun with the Pharaoh than Joseph?
I think it's a little looser. It's a blues number. And, I think there's a sense of irony coming back and playing the sort of the king or the pharaoh back at the Palladium.
Is he a baddie?
I don't know if he's a baddie. I think he's sort of, you know, he's reflective and, I don't know, God, I haven't really, it's only 8 minutes on stage, man.
So is it 8 minutes?
It's about ten minutes on stage, you know. But you've got to go in there with a bang, you know. Pharaoh, he was a powerful man with the ancient world at the palm of his hands.
So when you get a role that's 8.5 minutes on stage, right, you're obviously going to go for the curtain call at the end, aren't you?
Yes.
So
you've Do I turn up?
What, so I was going to say,
I haven't got to that negotiation. Normally, as performers, we have to really turn up at sort of the half to make sure that, you know, if things go wrong and people need to change. And
so you've got to turn up at the interval.
I'd like to think maybe I could sort of get there after the show goes up, but maybe that not be possible.
If I was you, right?
Yeah. Turn up at 5:00.
No, what I'd do is I'd go out for dinner with my mates and I'd say, I just got a nip out. And then I come back and I say, you'll never guess what I've just done. Yeah, that's what I would do.
Yeah. I sort of, I've never, to be honest with you, Chris, I've never really had, well, I've had lots of small roles, but you know, to take on this job, which was a massive part of my sort of history, and having such a small part has its advantages and its disadvantages, I suppose.
Okay, well,
because I quite like to work hard. You know, I've always been sort of, you know, getting there and get going, you know. So
you could do something else in the day and just, in a way, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing to nip out
there. It is, yeah, and it's a wonderful... You open sort of act two, you know, it's a really strong sort of character. And it defines, you know, the story in a major way.
Well, though. Jason, love to see you.
You too, man.
Everybody, let's all go and see Jason in the Technicolor Dreamcoat again, shall we?
Yes,
let's all go. Let's
just call it Jason and his amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. Let's change
Jason
history.
And the other guys. It's Jason and the other guys.
Great.
Go and see, not the Argonauts, Jason and the other guys. Jason, fantastic.
Thank you.
He started with the sprint. He finished even faster.
And if you walk past Talk Sport on your way out and they think you're an Australian cricketer, just say yes.
Just go, Azza!
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Shazam.
Yes.
Ish.
Shazam.
Well,
How's
that? Sherbet.
Sherbet. Oh, Daryl Braithwaite. Come on. Yeah, they will not have a clue.
Because they are.
Chapel, the Chappellis. Yeah.
Should we do it?
Oh, my God. How's that?
You missed the bat, I caught you out, how's that? Nobody knows where we're at. It's goodbye, so how's that? It's goodbye.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky Virgin Radio.
He starred in more genre-defining Hollywood classics than we could ever list. He's won an Oscar and he keeps it in, quite frankly, the coolest place in the house. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the living legend, Richard Dreyfuss.
Good morning, Richard. Yeah.
No. Don't get up.
No, come on. Let's get up. Let's get up.
Oh, boy.
We've never actually done a standing O before, ever. And we've been together for 100 years, us three.
Really?
Welcome. Right, come on, tell us about the Oscar in the coolest place in the house, which is, of course...
The refrigerator.
Tell us about that decision. That's funny.
Well, actually, it wasn't a big deal when I made the decision. It became a big deal because they would say, where do you keep your Oscar? And I would say, in the refrigerator. And they would say... Oh, that's amazing. Oh, that's amazing.
They were Dick Van Dyke.
I didn't say that, Dick. I didn't say that. And I'm not the one who badmouthed your accent.
I know, that's very dairy of you, actually, Vassos. So go on. So you'd say it was in the fridge, but was it in the fridge initially?
Yes.
So it was always in the fridge.
It was all because I didn't want to brag.
Right.
But I wanted everyone to know.
Yeah.
So I figured that the best way to do that was to have them go to the refrigerator
Sooner or later. So if you had guests around and they hadn't sort of alluded to the fact they might want something from the fridge, would you begin to suggest it, hoping that they would eventually?
Yes.
Perfect.
Yes. I would say, cucumber sandwiches, anybody? And then they would say, yes. I would say, well, go and pick one.
Is he still in the fridge?
He is.
Okay, because he's quite tall. So did you have to change the shelves around?
Yes. It's not that he's quite tall.
Right.
He is not as tall as Dick Van Dyke, for instance.
Yeah.
I once tried to get Dick Van Dyke to get into the refrigerator, but it didn't quite work out.
Have you seen other people's Oscars in their houses anywhere? Have you witnessed
yes.
other? Well, so give us some names and some places.
Marty Balsam, the actor,
yep.
He uses it as a doorstop.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Okay, I like that.
And I seen others. Let me see. I've heard that Barbara Streisand has at least one Oscar in a place of honor, and another in the loo,
yeah.
And which is actually a place of honor. And but I've never seen a touch of whimsy in the decision.
Okay, yours is the whimsy so far, so you win the prize for that. Now, you're sending us your questions to Jaws, about Jaws, for Richard to answer. Now, he says, if he's been asked the question before, we have to give him £50, and he won't even answer it. And then if he hasn't been asked the question before, he gives us 10, and he will answer it. So the questions I'm looking at here that you've sent in, thank you, by the way, we love you like brothers and sisters, but I'm scared to ask anything because I suspect that one's definitely been asked before.
Is your agent called Roland? Because we suspect Roland is definitely on your side here, Richard, either way. His question is...
Let me give you the first one as a freebie.
Okay. His question is, because this would be 50 quid.
Okay, go on.
Yeah.
How many teeth did Jaws have?
An uncountable amount, because that's the way sharks evolve. They evolve by biting and losing teeth, and the new teeth arrive, and you have to keep a count, you know. And the fact is, no one knows how many teeth a shark has, because they're constantly losing them and gaining them.
See, that's a proper answer.
It's a lovely answer. But is it £10 to us or £50 to you?
It's £50 to him, because he knows
the
answer.
I would say I owe that person $10.
You've never been asked that before?
No.
Well, so it is a game we can win.
Wow. Okay.
But then he said that was a freebie, so that doesn't exist. He's softening us up here, isn't he?
Oh, yes. It's the classic hustle.
It is. That's what
Let
he's doing.
Let them win small.
No, look, his little eyes lighting up there, Richard Dreyfuss.
The classic hustle.
Now, is it Dreyfuss or Dreyfuss?
It's Dreyfuss now, because you keep saying Dreyfuss and you're Richard Dreyfuss, and I'm not. Stephen Crowe. What kind of grass was on the dunes on the beaches where Jaws was filmed?
No one has ever asked me that, nor do I consider it about Jaws. And the first one about my agent, that's also not about Jaws.
Leslie says, question for Richard Dreyfuss, what sex was Jaws?
What sex?
Yes!
That's very good.
Come on, you owe us money now.
Well, it's true. I owe you $10 so far.
Oh, it's bucks now. It's bucks now, not pounds.
Suddenly gone down to about £8.
Yes, I would say no one has ever gotten close enough, long enough, to have that question asked. Because they don't let that happen.
The legend that Richard has been with us this morning, Richard Dreyfuss, thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard.
Awesome. Awesome.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky Virgin Radio.
Our next guest is the proud mother to 13-year-old daughter Billy. Her new book, out today, Meant to Be, takes us on her extremely personal journey through the heartbreak of infertility and the roller coaster that is adoption. Please welcome the queen of our screens, Lisa Faulkner.
Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning.
Why have you written this book now? Why not, of course, but why particularly now?
Because I have a lot of people that had come to me, or just I'd met over the years, that were saying how hard they'd found it if they'd done IVF and it hadn't worked, or they didn't know whether they wanted to do any more IVF or what to do. And I thought I wanted to write a book that was a bit of a hand to hold, because that whole journey is really lonely. Like, you think you've got family and friends around you, but it is just you sort of going through this stuff and thinking, feeling like a failure. And I wanted to be a sort of ray of, a chink of sunlight in it.
Well, good for you. And it is a beautiful book. It's very heartfelt. It's very sensitive. It's very honest. It's very naked. So when did you first think, let's have a baby?
I first thought about it when I was 30. And it's really funny. Up until then, it sort of hadn't entered my realm. I had my nieces who I loved, but I was not that sort of mumsy person that wanted a baby. And when it suddenly hit me, it was like, oh God, here it is. Yeah. And I was like, this is what I want to do next. And you always think, well, we'll just try, we'll see what happens. Mm-hmm. And we did, and it just, nothing happened.
Yes. So it starts off very relaxed. Okay, we'll give it a go. It'll be a bit of fun. I'll stop taking this. He'll stop doing that. And we'll get jiggy with it a bit more than perhaps we have been for a while or whatever. and then we'll just wait. And it's all fun. It's still fun. Oh, it's not as much fun. Oh, it was relaxed. It's a bit less relaxed now. And what happens next?
Exactly. And I think that's the time where you suddenly start going, everyone around you suddenly starts getting pregnant because they're all doing the same thing because you're all about the same age. And suddenly your joy for everyone getting pregnant turns into this sort of horrible feeling of, oh, when's it going to be my turn? And then into, oh, good for you. Great, I'm so pleased that you're pregnant, but I'm still not.
Yeah.
And then you start having to look at all these other things. In that whole time, I had an ectopic pregnancy, which was pretty horrible. And so I thought that it was all going to be wonderful, and then it wasn't. And then we started on IVF.
What did you do next?
We went through a whole series of what we were going to do next. And we looked at surrogacy, which surrogacy is an amazing thing. At the time, it still was amazing, but it was a tiny little charity and it scared me. And we had somebody come around to the house and explain what would happen. And I had to get my head around maybe my husband having a baby with somebody else because we couldn't afford to do IVF again. And actually, it all wasn't. I had to write a letter to the surrogate and had to be chosen. And that at that point, I thought, I can't be chosen. I don't know what to do anymore. And there were dark days. And it was then that my husband said to me, well, if you had a baby, if you were pregnant and I was filming away, I might not even see you. I could be away for 6 months and I could come back and you could hand me that baby and I would have no idea if it was mine or not and I would love it. So what's the difference, whether it's a child that we made or a child that needs a home? And that was it. It took a long time. It wasn't like I went, oh, and the lights went on and I went, oh, yes, that's exactly what we're going to do. But it really made me think, and about how many people I love in my life, and my nieces and my nephew and my godchildren and my friends and my partner. You know, you sort of realise how many people and what capacity you have to love. So why would it be any different? And so I just kept asking myself that question. Like, even, you know, the nights where the devil's on your shoulder at 4 o'clock in the morning and you wake up and you can, your head's going crazy. And then I would keep saying, can I do that? And would I be able to love a child that I hadn't made? And the answer was just yes. And I thought, I'm going to do that.
So when you finally did, or were offered the chance to parent a little girl.
Yep.
She was how old?
She was 18 months old. And she's amazing. And yes, it was tough. And I think it's a really, really hard process. And you just don't know. You don't know how it's going to work out. You don't know if you're going to be good enough. I mean, there was a lot of time where I was thinking, am I going to be, you know, the parent that she needs? Am I going to be good enough? Because you're there and you've wanted it for so long. And then it comes and you're like, oh my gosh. And there's a little person running around your world and you're like, okay, this is it. But I've learned every day from it. I mean, I just think it is the most incredible thing. And parenting, I'm sure you'd say with birth children, it's exactly the same. You learn every day. They surprise you and they do things and different phases of life that they go through. And I just feel very honoured that I can be there, that I can be the person to look after her and love her and help her and, you know, make her a grounded, lovely person.
Rachel hasn't stopped crying for the last, 20 minutes. These are tears of joy now because we're over the sad bit. Is that right?
It's just your story is very inspirational and emotional because becoming a parent is the biggest thing that can happen to somebody. And to just hear how you have gone through all of those challenges and to see you today and the smile on your face, you're an incredible mum. Congratulations.
Do you know what? Thank you. Because I'm just a mum and I make mistakes and whatever. But I just, it really means a lot to me that you think that you've read it, that you see that there is another way. Do you know what? That's all there is that if you want to do something, you work it out and you do it, you know?
This is a book of gratitude, an explanation and warmth and love. It's called Meant to Be. It's by Lisa Faulkner. And despite how it might sound, we're really glad you came in today.
Oh, thank you.
It's great for you to come in. This book it's a lovely book. It's out today. Meant to Be by Lisa Faulkner, My Journey to Motherhood.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We've heard from three guests already, but there's loads more still to come. Neurologist and brain surgeon Dr. Raul Jandial tells us how to look after our grey matter. Arthur Smith chats his new stage show, Sid, and survival expert John Hutton shares some phenomenal survival stories. All that and more, but first, Dapper Dave, who's next?
Our next guest is a Sherlock on Mr. Selfridge superstar. She's worked her magic on the play The Sun, which after a hugely successful initial run is transferring to the West End later this year. Please welcome back an actress of infinite ability. It's the wonderful Amanda Abington.
Good morning, Amanda. Hey. Darling.
Hello, sweetheart.
How are we today?
Really well.
So The Sun transferring to Duke of York's Theatre in London's West End from Saturday 24th of August to Wednesday the 2nd of November. Transferring means it's gone well.
Yes, okay. It did go really well. We were very pleased.
When things go from the West End to elsewhere, that's okay too,
yes,
because they're still going on. But
yes,
this is the perfect way around. This is the way you want it,
this
isn't
is
it?
This is how you want it,
so,
yeah.
So where's it been on and
it
how
was
people...
At the Kiln, which was formerly known as the Tricycle in Kilburn.
Yep.
And Florian Zeller, who wrote The Sun, that's where he put on his last three. It's a third of a trilogy of three of his plays. So there was the mother, the father, the mother, and the son.
Love it.
And this is the last one. And he's put all of those on at the Kiln first. And now it's going.
And they all transferred.
I think they did. Yes, they did. Yeah.
Okay, David knows about this.
I don't. I'm a theatre
Luddite. Luddish.
Yes.
Yeah, not Luddish. Yeah. Luddish. Okay. So tell us about The Sun. Come on. Sell some tickets. Put some bums on seats.
It's
love.
A really good play.
There you go.
And also, it hasn't got an interval, and it runs straight through, and it's down by 9:15. So, you know, you can still go out for a meal afterwards. It's great. I get quite offended when I have to sit through 3 hours of theatre.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Like,
I'm like, come on
offended.
Now. Yeah, I do. I'm
actually
thinking.
Actually offended.
Yeah.
Okay, what about 3 hours of a movie? Because a Magnolia's long and I love Magnolia.
It depends on the film.
Magnolia.
It depends on the film, to be fair.
Okay, best long film ever. Best long film ever, anyone?
Godfather was quite long. Yeah.
Which one? Two?
Yeah, two, yeah.
Okay, so I'd go Magnolia. Do you like Magnolia?
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, it bombed, didn't it?
It nearly tore the
heart out of the director and writer's career.
Philip Seymour Hoffman was just beautiful.
Philip Seymour Hoffman was... Well, everybody's great.
Everybody's
John C. Reilly was in it as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so Godfather 2. I'm going Magnolia all the way. Vassos.
I don't have the patience to sit for a long film.
Hang on a minute.
It's over 100 minutes. I'm done.
Right, okay, here's what's really weird about that, right?
Go on.
He runs ultramarathons.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you have the patience for that, for a 12-hour run.
Yeah, no problem.
For the Spartathlon, from where was that?
That was Athens to Sparta. That was more like 28 hours.
28. So you have the patience for that, but not to sit on the sofa and watch a movie.
What if you watched it from a treadmill?
Oh, no, don't run on a treadmill.
Combine it all.
Okay, best long film ever, Rachel?
I don't know.
Long films.
Like Lord of the Rings?
Yeah, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Okay, so now I'm going Magnolia over Godfather 2. So the Sun is transferring to Amanda Abington's in it, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, exactly.
The Sun transferring to Duke York Theatre in London, in the West End, from Saturday the 24th of August. Now it doesn't say on the poster. Please tell me it doesn't say on the poster. You'll be done by 9:15.
No, I will be telling people that as they come in. Don't worry, you'll be done by 9:15. I remember standing at the box office at the Kiln, and there was this wonderful couple of ladies, and they were standing there, and she said, so is there an interval in this? And this woman said, no, it just goes straight through. She went, but I'm menopausal. I need to go to the toilet. And she said, why was that not on the ticket? And he said, well, I'm really sorry. She said, if you go at the beginning, then she said, don't tell me how to go to the toilet, young lady. And it started to get a bit minty. And I said, look, it's a really good play, so...
Thumbs up in your face in between those thumbs works for me every single time. But if you rethink, because we went to this festival last week in Ken about alternative thinking, it was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. Alternative thinking is original thinking. The ideas that you have are just basically your inner analysis of knowledge that you've downloaded, and then it's not original thinking. They're useful. You can come up with solutions. You can solve things via things you've learned and experience and
analysis, painting by numbers, if you like. But original thought, alternative thinking is amazing. Now, I would do this. If I ran some theatre in London, some theatre, not all theatre, maybe if I ran all theatre, I would start things earlier and finish them at 9 so you can still go out for dinner. Because people go for a pre-theatre dinner, and when I've eaten, all I want to do is go to sleep.
Yeah, I do.
And theatres are very comfortable. They're quite warm.
Oh, I've nodded.
They're
over
warm.
So,
yeah, of course you have.
Absolutely.
9:15. I'm coming to the play just so at 9:15 I can take Tash out for dinner afterwards.
Exactly, and it's right in the heart of London's West
right
End.
Right in the heart of London's West End.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
Our next guest really knows what's going on inside your head. He's one of the top brain surgeons in the world, and here to take us through his fascinating new book, Life Lessons from a Brain Surgeon. Please welcome your brain's best buddy, the nifty neuroscientist, Dr. Rahul Jandayal.
Oh, yeah, very good. Good morning, Rahul.
I love that introduction.
Did you? I bet you
nifty
did.
Neurosurgeon or nifty neuroscientist.
Right, so you are a neuroscientist, you're a brain surgeon, you're a very clever man. So first of all, our brain, okay, we go to the gym, we get on the treadmill, we go on the cross trainer,
yep.
We go to the multi-gym. Mm-hmm. Okay, we know what to do with that. If I want to expand my lung capacity, I'll go swimming, I'll learn to hold my breath longer. What can I do to help my brain? What can I do today to help my brain?
Well, there's three fundamental things you can do today to help your brain. And one is go to that gym you mentioned, because the brain is flesh. So just like muscle is flesh or the heart is flesh, the brain is flesh and needs to be irrigated. So it's got arteries and plumbing. So if you clog your heart arteries, you're also going to clog your brain arteries. So staying fit is very important to staying mentally sharp. Number two, just change your diet just a little bit. Enjoy food, but maybe cut out the red meat and the fried food and lean towards fish and lean towards vegetables and plants and maybe even a touch of red wine. So those indulgences can be healthy for you. Yep, you're smiling. I see that. And the other one is to challenge yourself. I was at the exhibit in the Body World, and it says thirst for challenge. So it doesn't matter where you're at with your intellectual abilities or prowess, if you will. Go one level just beyond that. Challenge your mind, and thinking flesh is what the brain really is. So get up and move around a little bit. Think a little bit and just change your diet a little bit, and you'll have larger impacts than you suspect.
Okay, now our brains, they're not suspended, they float. What do they float in?
that's the most interesting part is when you open the skull, there's a sheath. You don't see the brain right away. It's like parachute material. You have to lift it up like a teepee and you incise it. And the first thing that happens is all this white. She's
stick with it, Rachel. Stick with it.
Okay. I haven't even mentioned blood.
Very visual.
Mentioned tissue. But there's this white fluid that comes off and it pours off the top of your skull. So the brain and spinal cord are not resting inside you. They are buoyant and floating. And if they do rest and hit the bottom of your skull, you get a gnarly headache or you get other injuries like with concussions. It's the slamming of the brain against the inside of your cranial vault that leads to injury. It wants to be buoyant. Think of it as a jellyfish tightly packed into an aquarium.
But pain is just in the brain, isn't it?
Interesting. Pain is all in your mind. So what's that joke where the doctor says, where does it hurt? And then somebody answers, I don't know. It's in my head. That's where it hurts. So pain is a very complicated thing. I will tell you, there's only one tissue in the human body that does not feel pain directly, and that's the brain. Back to opening up the skull, I can touch the surface of the brain while somebody's awake, and they don't know I'm touching it.
And you've done this before.
Oh, yeah. Awake brain surgery, it's in the book.
Yeah, it's in the book. And
but the rest of the pain comes from the body's nerves.
Yeah.
Because the brain itself doesn't feel anything.
One of the few things that can benefit a brain surgeon when he or she are doing what they do is in some cases, it's more beneficial to keep the patient awake. So you have to put them under to get into the brain because that's painful. But then you can dial down the anesthetic because it's very important that the patient can talk to the surgeon to advise him on what effect he's doing is having.
Because the address for language is fuzzy. We can get down to the neighborhood, but we don't know the exact address. And in each one of us, that's different. So when I hear things like, oh, happiness lives here in the brain and hangovers come from this part of the brain, it doesn't make sense to me. And the gritty, gripping stories in the book are to illustrate, one, I know a little bit about this topic, and two, maybe we should take a step back before we believe all the assumptions that we're reading online.
What about beyond the brain? Okay, because one of our brain's biggest talents is the fact that it's great at its own PR. It's like, I am the cleverest thing here. But neurons are all over the place, and you have your gut feeling. You feel love in your chest,
like,
and you have your gut feeling. You tend to, because you have inner knowledge, you have neurons. You can think with other parts of your body, can't you? That is a thing.
Yeah, I like that. I like that topic because I don't want people to think of this master alien organ sitting on top of the head, separate from the body. And what people do is when they show the brain, they fail to show all the tentacles that are running down the neck to your body. We do have gut feelings. We do have instincts. And interestingly, your brain can slow down your heart rate, which technically you shouldn't be able to do, because even if you're knocked out or you're sleeping, your heart is beating. So you can think down some of your bodily functions. And interestingly, with deep, controlled, meditative breathing, it's not mindfulness, it's controlling your breathing. You can actually shower your brain in reverse with calming electrical signals. So there is a mind-body connection. It's just not a lot of that fluff that we're seeing on the internet or in magazines.
My sense of being nowadays is much more below the neck than above the neck. So I spend most of the day feeling things below the neck, and I can sense this bowling ball perched on my shoulders, which used to dominate everything, but it doesn't happen anymore. And even talking to you now, I'm speaking from below my voice box as opposed to from above it. Thoughts aren't raining down, they're percolating up.
Yeah, I like that thought a lot. I wonder if that's a transition I'm going into. I'm 46 years old, and in the beginning when I started my career with science and brain surgery, it was very top-down. And now there's a flow and a rhythm to me operating where I'm actually asking my frontal lobes to stay out of the way. It's like kicking a football goal or soccer goal or throwing a pass in NFL in the States or being in the ballet. You kind of have to learn it and then you got to let it go.
Yeah.
And I think that is the wisdom that comes with age and sort of maybe a more homeostatic balance between mind and body. But I don't think of instincts as separate from thought. In fact, instincts to me are rarer than thought, and that's what separates some people.
Here. You're amazing. Life lessons from a brain surgeon. Could talk to him all day. I will do in my own way. We won't be together, but we'll be on the same frequency for the next 24 hours. Dr. Rahul Jandial, once again, that book, Life Lessons from a Brain Surgeon.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky Virgin Radio.
He's the godfather of British alternative comedy, a mainstay of the Edinburgh Festival and self-proclaimed mayor of Balham. His show, Sid, starts a run at London Soho Theatre from this Friday, and here to tell us all about it, please welcome the total geezer, the audience pleaser, the one and only Arthur Smith.
Morning, hey, Arthur.
Thank you. Good morning, Chris.
Sid, tell us who Sid is, was.
Sid was my dad, who was a sort of ordinary man who lived through some extraordinary times. He was in the war. He was captured at El Alamein. He ended the war as a prisoner of war in Colditz Castle. And then he became a copper, wandering not far from here, actually. You know, if you were here 70 years ago, you could get arrested by my dad for being drunk on the South Bank. And it's about being a dad, about the war and what it was like in the 40s and 50s. And there are some hilarious stories because my father wrote a memoir in his police report prose and his copper plate writing full of a whole load of extraordinary stories about the war and about being a copper.
So his story via you, or some of his story, some of your story melded together.
Yes.
Dad's united, if you like.
Yes, it's a bit that. It's mainly about him and the times that he went through and how, despite everything, he was a very gentle, kind man. Most dad shows, you know, it's not uncommon for comedians to do dad shows are about how your dad was horrible or died young or had dementia or something, whereas mine's a kind of a hymn to being a decent man. And just, I mean, some of the things he went through, fighting in El Alamein and being a copper, he's got some hilarious stories. Funny enough, just near here, there was a block of buildings he had to go and tell someone that her husband had died. They'd separated and he knocked on the door and he was very nervous. And she answered, he said, I very much get to say your husband has died. And she said, has he? And shut the door. and about arresting drunken women a lot, and how he didn't really like arresting people, actually. I think it's partly what he'd been through during the war. He didn't really want to hurt anyone. He just wanted to be gentle and to help people.
And to have somebody in your life who can tell these stories firsthand, because my mum was in the war, yeah. And she used to tell me these stories all the time. She worked in a munitions factory.
Oh, really?
And she talked about these stories where the telegram boy used to arrive.
Yeah, the most terrifying thing.
Because
if a telegram arrived, it was quite likely to say that your son had been killed. And, you know, that must have been awful when people banged on the door. That's part of the idea of the show, is to get people to talk about their parents and grandparents and what it was like in the war. Because I think it's hard for us to imagine now quite what it was like the Blitz, for example, you know, when it was a complete blackout. But actually, that was a very sexy time because, of course, the lights were off. You might be dead tomorrow. The comedian Kenneth Williams, who I once shared a train journey with, told me that the only time he'd ever really felt sexually fulfilled was during the war, during the Blitz. Because, you know, no one really knew what was going on. Yeah, it was all dark. And
that's why people smoked as well, wasn't it? Because, why not? Almost. Yeah. It was a why not time, wasn't it?
Yeah, although they didn't really know smoking was bad for you then, mind.
No, I was not.
Apparently it is, I've heard.
Yeah, but my mum started smoking when she was 11, and she talks about the Blitz, because we lived in Warrington, so we're between Liverpool and Manchester, and she was at a fun fair once, and she was at the top of the big wheel, and the sirens went off, and the man who was running the big wheel ran to the shelter and turned the big wheel off, and there's my mum and her mate at the top of the big wheel watching the whole of the Blitz that night. What did they do? They were 12 years old. They sparked up a cigarette and said, okay, well, here we are.
Yeah.
Here we are and here we go. We can't begin to imagine. I mean,
no.
It used to infuriate, my mum passed away last year, but it used to infuriate her how bothered we got about things now that aren't important relatively, respectively.
Yes, I think it was a very serious thing. And I mean, the world was about to end. You might be invaded. We might all be speaking German. There was death everywhere. It was pretty important times. I think sometimes we should remember now that actually maybe it's not so bad if someone was rude to you on Twitter.
So your show is 2 hours-ish?
It's it depends which way I'm doing it, if I've got an interval or not. It'll probably only be an hour or just over an hour in Soho. And there's some songs as well. I'm doing a bit of singing.
Come on, tell us about those.
Well, my father, I've picked some songs that my father liked and some that I liked. And I've got the Smithereens, who helped me with it. I'm doing Waterloo Sunset. I'm doing the odd Leonard Cohen song and... you know, there's some singing to add atmosphere to the sparks and the war and the coppers.
All right, and you say you change it. You change it from time to time.
Yes.
What are you tinkering with now?
Yes, I am. I'm debating whether to have it chronologically or whether to move back and forth. It's a constant thing with creating a narrative. Is there a better way of doing it? Might it be more interesting if I put that line there? In a sense, you never stop rewriting things. I mean, even things I did 25 years ago, if I look at them, I think, oh, maybe I could do that a bit better now.
All right, Arthur. Brilliant. OK, so this has been done before. He knows what he's doing. It's about his dad. It's about a first-hand tale of a story. And you encourage everybody else, if you've got 75th anniversary of D-Day just a couple of weeks ago, if you know somebody who was there, get them to talk on your phone. I got my mum to talk loads just before she passed away on the phone about stuff, just so it's down.
That's right, absolutely. Because when they die, your parents, you'll think, oh, I wish I'd known a bit more about what they did then. And bring them along to my show as well, and we'll all have a chat afterwards.
Okay, arthursmith.co.uk. Sid is the show, Soho Theatre is the venue, from Friday the 20th of June to a couple of weeks later, Saturday the 13th of July. Thank you, Arthur.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
From playing Gordon Brown in Westminster to walloping zombies in The Walking Dead, our next guest is a guaranteed mark of quality. His new play, The End of History, started its run at the Royal Court Theatre last night, and here to tell us about it, it's the big daddy of British acting, it's David Morrissey!
Big Daddy. Well, it's his intro.
Is this a wrestling theme, is it?
Dapper Dave, Big Daddy. Big Daddy's real name?
Shirley Crabtree.
Correct. Number one adversary?
My adversary? No, his was it Giant Haystack?
Giant Haystack! Yeah. All right. Brilliant. Okay, name three other wrestlers from
McManus.
70s, yes.
Jackie Palo.
And
Tally Ho Kay.
Yeah, I would have gone for Kendo Nagasaki.
You might have done, yeah. That was a great moment when he took his mask off. Remember that?
Yes, I do.
And he had the red eyes.
I do remember that.
Oh, it was the scariest thing
Quarter
I've
ever to five,
seen.
World of Sport every Saturday.
Dickie Davis.
Just after Rallycross, yeah, Dickie Davis. Dickie Davis, who had dark hair with a little skunky grey.
He had the Malin streak, didn't he?
Yeah, the Malin streak.
This, like, grey streak through his... And then he just went totally grey.
Well, no, what he did was... And he's still around, by the way. Good morning, Dickie, if you're listening. I hope you are, because you're awesome. He went grey. So what he did was he dyed the bit that used to be grey when he was dark.
Right.
So he sort of... He
became the negative of himself.
Yeah, exactly. Right, so you are play fresh, David Morrissey.
Well, play fresh. Okay. I wouldn't go that far.
Well, it happened last night.
Yes, it did.
Okay, so you played to actual real people last night for the first time.
Yeah, we did, yeah.
Is it a brand new play?
Yeah, it's a brand new play by Jack Thorne, yeah, who wrote The Virtues, which has just been on Channel 4.
Which people are raving about. I haven't seen it myself.
Shane Meadows and Stephen Graham, yeah, it's fantastic.
Oh, no, of course. I saw the first one because Shane was on the show.
Yeah.
Right, so we have... We have a family, we have a mum and dad, and we have kids getting back together over a meal and then retracing their lives via three separate moments.
It's three acts and it goes over 30 years and it's about family gatherings over one day over 30 years, yeah. And the parents are sort of the left, they are politically of the left, and their children make different choices in their life. But it's... And it's about how we deal with those choices as parents, as our children take their own choices and they might not be within our wishes or whatever. But it's very funny. It's Leslie Sharp, myself, Kate O'Flynn. It's a great cast.
So 1997 is the first moment that you go back to. So Blair has just enjoyed a landslide victory in the elections.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he's just got into power. So it's this wave of enthusiasm in the country, of which my character is very much part of and sort of joyous about. But the wife is much more suspicious of him. She's a Greenham woman. She's very politically active and she's suspicious of him. But the kids have just, you know, just started university, just leaving school, things like that. And then as they come into the next section, the kids have made their choices. They're working in corporate London. They're sort of, you know, their marriages are fully formed. And my son has married someone that we're not totally happy about. She's very, very rich. She's sort of connected. And it's about those schisms that happen between us and our children as they grow older and they make their choices.
See, again, I want to see this straight away. It sounds brilliant. So it's very much around Blair, the first vignette.
Yeah, well, it's his government's just come in. But it's all about the dreams and aspirations. And of course, you know, when you're playing someone in 97, you as a character, you're much more of the 70s. That's when you were politically formed. It's when you were musically formed. So it's when did they become the adults they are, even though we're playing people in their 50s, in their early 50s in the first scene. Their real formation of character and who they are took place in the 70s. Yeah, so all their musical references, all their political
and that's
references.
That's all in there, is it?
That's all there, you know.
That.
So it's all about them.
And so does Blair appear via conversation?
He's on the radio.
He's on the radio.
We hear him on the radio,
cool.
There's a little bit of Radio 4.
And is it actually him?
No, it's an announcement. So just before he comes on and makes the announcement, Leslie Sharp, my wife, she turns the radio off. She darts across the room to turn the radio off because she doesn't want to hear him.
Right.
So that's the one thing that happens. So he's a presence. Certainly his government is, but New Labour is a presence.
Is it controversial at all, David?
Yeah, it does throw up things about our modern living that we...
For example?
Well, just that sense of entrenched wealth and inheritance and how we see our homes and property more as an asset rather than a home, rather than a place to live.
Yeah.
We see it as getting on the property market.
All right, so 1997, so the family are there in 97, the parents are in their middles, I would imagine, then, 40-somethings.
Yeah.
Okay, so Blair's just come in. The next time they visit themselves is when they're thinking about handing things on, so they've become property owners, they're thinking about their wills.
Their wills. And then the last act is how they do that and why they need to do that.
Well, that sounds like there's some intrigue about it.
Yes, there's a little bit of intrigue. I can't give
that
away.
Oh, no, God, this is great.
So the last act is very much a reveal of what's going to happen.
What has been happening under the surface?
Yeah, what's been going on, and the children find out out about it as they get.
I like it. Yeah. I like it a lot.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
If you're planning a jungle expedition, a desert trek, an Arctic adventure, or just popping to the shops, you really have to listen to our next guest. With his new book, How to Survive, Lessons for Everyday Life from the Extreme World, out tomorrow. Please welcome Chief Survival Instructor to the UK military. It's the wonderful John Hudson.
Morning, John.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Ever smiling. Okay, you'd never know, would you, Vassos?
That he's
the UK military chief survival instructor.
No.
You wouldn't know.
No, did your book rights cover, mate?
Okay, no, it's great. It's great. So how did you get that job, first of all?
I've been there the longest. Everyone else left.
So you're still in the military?
Yeah, I'm a full-time reservist, Chris. So I do Monday to Friday, 8 till 5, and a few sort of expedition type things in between as well.
Right, now your book is full of real stories, and then you sort of go back and you analyse those stories and you say, okay, how come that person survived?
Yeah.
So you open with a story in 1971 about a 17-year-old girl
yes.
who fell 2 miles to Earth after the plane she was in exploded.
Yeah.
That's who you start with.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it? Juliana Kupka. And there was nothing that she did that was wrong, and she was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, she got on an aeroplane, it got struck by lightning, it fell to pieces. The interesting part of that story, I think, is not so much, well, it's spectacular that she fell for 2 miles and didn't die, but that she managed to, a 17-year-old kid, managed to crawl for 11 days and get rescued. And that's just down to her knowing one simple thing that her father had told her. And that's like, listen, not just stay where you are and wait to get rescued, but listen. She listened for water. She followed a little rivulet of water that became a stream. Stream became a river, crawling and walking, blind in one eye, no shoes, found a person at the end of that 11-day hike.
Because he said if you carry on following water, you'll probably come across civilization
yeah.
or population of some sort, which is
yeah.
what happened.
That's right.
And she had 10 days she survived with only a bag of boiled sweets
yeah,
as food.
Amazing.
Which were also on the plane, bizarrely.
Yeah, she found some stuff on the floor of the forest, because obviously as it exploded, things got scattered all over the place. So there were some other bits, but she sort of decided what she wanted to take with her, and there was just a bag of boiled sweets, and that was her for 11 days.
But there was some knowledge behind her survival.
Yes.
And subsequently they found out that 14 other people survived the fall miraculously, however, didn't survive the forest.
Yeah, and that's still a subject of some debate, Chris. So there was sort of analysis later of some of the people who died, and they decided they'd been in the forest for less time than someone who'd been on the forest floor for like 2 weeks. So they'd obviously been alive for a bit and then started to kind of, you know, be absorbed by the forest later.
So it's listen, it's remember, it's recall, yep. and it's put into action.
Yes.
Okay, so the most impressive story in your own book that you came across and decided to include.
Right, so to me, the one that I go back to most often with the guys I train is Dale Zelko's story. Back in 99, so 20 years ago this March, stealth bombers, probably remember those.
Yep.
They were doing an operation to help free former Yugoslavia from the war that was going on there. Everyone thought they were invisible. Everybody in the media thought they were invisible, but Dale got shot down. And it's what he did before he got shot down so that he performed exceptionally well afterwards that I like, because it's preparing for the unexpected. Even if it's vanishingly small, there are all things we can all do to perform better. And that's the key message, I suppose, that no matter how normal we all feel, there are exceptional things we can all do with a little bit of pre-thinking and a tiny bit of pre-preparation.
Well, they seem exceptional, actually, but they're not, are they? That's sort of the point.
Yes.
They seem exceptional in the circumstances until you realise, no, this was already in the computer.
Exactly.
And so what did he do?
Well, Dale, before he went flying, he just thought about the what-ifs. So he'd already trained, he drilled in what to do if there was a real emergency. Nobody expected the airplane to get shot down, but he managed to eject. And then after that, it's what he did that's important. Because he'd pre-thought the worst case what-ifs, I love the bed, by the way, but it's a bit of roses, that's mega.
So
he'd offloaded all that heavy lifting that his brain had to do so that he had a bit of lateral thought and capability. And what Dale did is actually under the parachute, over enemy territory at night, got a little radio out of his pocket that he wasn't meant to really use until much later, and started talking to his mates. And by chatting to his mates early, his mates knew he was in distress and like, this shouldn't happen. And you can hear the audio. It's actually on YouTube, the
wow.
audio of that. Calls Mayday, and people are like, shivers down your spine time. It's what's happening. That can't be happening. Stealth bombers don't get shot down. You know, that's what they're thinking, and you can hear it in their voices. But he convinces them that, you know, I am actually out of this aeroplane. And
right.
you're going to have to come and get me.
Right, there's some brilliant super tips here. Like, if you suspect somebody is talking about you on the phone to somebody else and they don't know, but you're in the next cubicle to them in the toilet during a comfort break and you can't quite hear what they're saying, then you can amplify your hearing. How do we do that, John?
How do we do that, Chris? I can't remember that tip,
okay,
mate.
Well, you say, because the inside of your head...
I'm with you. Sorry, mate, I'm with you. So, So apologies about that. I was like, where's this one going? Yes, yes, yes. So yeah, because we're just a complicated system of cavities and pressures.
Yeah.
And I should have had mine more open when you were making that point a minute ago.
Well, you're too busy listening to the Stone Roses, know, by the way. That's the issue
it.
There.
I'm loving this continuous waterfall. Can I have it when I go?
Of course you can.
Yeah, so you just open your mouth slightly and that increases the amount of movement you can have in your inner ear, in your eardrum. And that's something we teach people to do at night as well. So if you can close your eyes, if you can open your mouth, and then if you move your head from side to side, your ears act like little radar dishes and you can detect which direction the sound's coming from.
What about rehearsing more? Tell us about that.
Yeah, if you've got something difficult to do, prepare yourself and prepare yourself, if you can, in the right space that you're going to deliver that thing. Because it's been proven that we perform better in context, and they did that using underwater training, so you don't need to do it underwater, obviously, but if you can prepare in the context that you're going to be tested in, it's called an episodic memory, so you'll remember it far better. It's anchored in you rather than something that you're trying to remember from red learning, which is a semantic memory.
We're going to do summer camps for kids next year. Would you come and be part of that?
Yeah, mate, definitely.
Okay, How to Survive, Lessons for Everyday Life from the Extreme World. This is it's a brilliant, brilliant book. John Hudson.
Thanks, mate.
It's a solid 9 out of 10.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
Thank you so much for listening to this, the podcast of the Virgin Radio Breakfast Show. Don't forget you can subscribe and get it every week from wherever you get your podcast, and you will never miss the weekly roundup of all the best bits from our Virgin Radio Breakfast Show with Sky.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.